welcome to the View My Seats podcast. I'm your host, John Lord. With me today to talk the round of 16 at the World Cup, including Tuesday's tilt between the United States and Belgium, is my buddy Herx. Herxy, what are your expectations with tomorrow's game?
A lot of nerves, no question about that. It'll be hopefully a better matchup than the friendly that U.S. and Belgium played, probably, I don't know, 8 months ago now? 4 months ago? One of the two? But it'll be an interesting matchup. And the next, 24, 36 hours will be very tough for Belgium, given a lot of the news coming out of their camp with their roster shakeups that are going on because of injury.
Can you take a second to explain some of that? Because I am not as aware as you are about the roster changes.
Sure. The Belgium roster has been virtually, or their starting lineup, I should say, has been virtually unchanged over the course of their first three games. But over the last 2 days or so, there have been questions coming out about their, primarily, most importantly for them, their captain, Vincent Kompany, who plays for Man City as his club team. He's a towering central defender. He's an incredible soccer player. But there are questions now about his health. I believe it's his hamstring that was bothering him. So between him, one of their other defenders, Thomas Vermaelen, has had some questions about his health raised in the last couple of days. It could really throw the defensive back line of Belgium, into a second string situation. And that's never good coming off, three group games, going into your first knockout game to not be sure who your starting lineup is going to be.
And from what I understand about Belgium, they're strongest in the back. Is that correct? Their defense is what gives them an advantage in most of these games?
Absolutely. The Belgium defense is really built similarly to what Klinsmann has done with the U.S., with wanting a possession defense to build out of the back, build through the midfield, and not just play a long ball and try to bomb down the field and run onto it, chase it down. And both Vermaelen and Kompany have the foot skill to be able to do that. And if those two are out or are hampered in any way, they're going to have to change their tactics a little bit too.
So if the Belgium side is a little nicked up right now, what are the chances that the United States sees Jozy Altidore in Tuesday's game?
Last I heard from Klinsmann and from the U.S. camp, it was looking pretty good. The question will be not so much will he play, it'll be more how much will he play and how effective will he be. Will they throw him out there with the hope of, he's at 90% and have him start, or will they hold him back even if he's at 90% and go with what worked so well against Portugal, go with what worked decently well against Germany, and then bring him in as a sub for the last 20, 30 minutes of the game, no matter what the situation is.
I've grown to appreciate the United States team without Altidore these last three games, so you're going to have to explain to me how exactly he changes the nature of this team. Is it at this point for the better? Where does he fit in? Who does he play for? I'm interested to understand how that dynamic changes with this team if Altidore returns to some form of health.
I think the biggest change for the U.S. would be being able to drop Clint Dempsey off the front line and have him play as more of a central attacking midfielder. That role has been filled by Michael Bradley, who, despite the hustle, despite the grit that and the work rate that he's put in, has not been at his sharpest because he's been asked to do something completely foreign to him. The creativity, the attack-mindedness is not his. It's not a role that he's ever had to play for the U.S., let alone for a club team. And that's more suited for Dempsey than it is for Bradley. So to allow Dempsey to drop into that spot, move Bradley around and give him more of the freedom that he had through qualifying, that he had, early on in the Ghana game, that would be the biggest change, so that Dempsey can work with Altidore instead of being stranded, you know, alone by himself trying to do everything.
Michael Bradley has faced a lot of criticism regarding his play these last 2 weeks, and some of it is warranted, some of it is not. He is obviously one of the most recognizable players on the team, and I think you'd agree that maybe it's because he's playing out of position. He's not playing in a position that he's accustomed, but he hasn't looked sharp at all times, especially with his first touches. I mean, even I can tell, and I'm not a soccer expert, even I can tell that some of his first touches on the ball have been less than expert. So with Bradley, you're not going to pull him off the pitch and people calling for Klinsmann to do something with Bradley as far as making a sub for him are ridiculous. I mean, he's still one of the United States' best players, so he's got to be on the field. But maybe having Altidore on the field means Dempsey moves back a little bit, puts Bradley in a more comfortable position, and then that gives us the best Michael Bradley, which is probably something the United States will need if they're going to beat Belgium.
Absolutely. You know, it's you got it right. There's been a lot of criticism of Bradley because he's not been sharp. He's made some poor decisions that look very much like he's trying to force the ball. He's trying to put it in, you know, a 2 foot ball into a 1 foot area. He's been making decisions that just aren't going to work. And a lot of that probably comes from the pressure of being out of position and all the tournament hype on this is the best player. The way that Bradley goes is the way the U.S. will go. And is that unfair? No, because it's true. You know, Bradley has been the engine of this team for the last, you know, 3-4 years, and without him, you know, we wouldn't be in this position.
The New York Times, I think it was the New York Times, ran something fairly interesting about how Michael Bradley has run more than any other player at this year's World Cup. Could he possibly just be tired? Is that the reason why his first touches on the ball haven't been what we're accustomed to seeing from a player of his stature, or is it pressure? I feel that he hasn't obviously looked his best, and that turnover against Portugal that led to that equalizer in the final minute there was, I mean, a lot of things went wrong on that play. You know, Jeff Cameron maybe not getting back to the central defense as quickly, preventing that cross from Ronaldo. But Michael Bradley has run a lot, and maybe he, like a lot of the other players, are just tired.
It certainly wouldn't help the situation, that's for sure. But for every time that I watching Bradley play in a game question, you know, his fitness question, how tired he was, before that turnover in the Portugal game, and it was the same at the end of the Ghana game, that last 15 or 20 minutes of the match, when everybody started slowing down and everybody started looking tired, Bradley looked the exact same. You know, those last five minutes of the Portugal game, notwithstanding.
That's true.
But he has that ridiculous engine, that ridiculous energy that has carried him through, you know, 85, 88 minutes to that point, and he just doesn't quit. He doesn't give up. It's incredible to see.
With since we kind of transitioned to the defensive side of the field for the United States, I know a little bit about who Belgium has on offense, their strikers. But first, before we talk about Belgium's offense, will the United States stick with Omar Gonzalez against Belgium instead of Jeff Cameron? I thought Omar Gonzalez, a little shaky at the start against Germany, but he came up big a couple of times with a few crosses, getting his head on the ball, getting his foot in front of Ozil and other players. So I thought Omar Gonzalez looked good. But if you're Klinsmann, do you give Jeff Cameron another chance against Belgium, or do you stick with somebody like Omar Gonzalez?
honestly, when that lineup came out and Gonzalez was plugged in, I threw my phone.
People who watched this national team were not on the same page with Klinsmann with Gonzalez in the lineup because he had not been playing a lot prior to the World Cup, right? Somebody said something that he hadn't played 90 minutes in months.
Yeah, he was coming off an injury. You know, he picked up I don't remember what it was, but it was a leg injury of some kind, and he hadn't gone a full match, and you know, he hadn't gone a full match in California during spring, let alone in Brazil in, you know, what is essentially summer. It made no sense to a lot of people, and you know, it worked out for him though. You know, just like Cameron in the beginning of the Ghana game, nerves definitely played a part for Gonzalez too. But he got it under control. He bounced back and he had himself one hell of a game.
So the chances are that you would expect Klinsmann to stick with somebody like an Omar Gonzalez. The one thing that tactically I wonder about is, that Belgium's best striker is tall dude with the afro, right? Fellini?
He's definitely their biggest threat. I wouldn't say that he's their best striker, because of the time that he's been given. You know, he kind of floats in and out.
He's their super sub. He comes in kind of last 25 minutes or so.
Right. But just like the reason that he's a scary prospect is just like Omar Gonzalez, he's tall and he can ball in the air, he's going to win 9 out of 10 times. So if you're looking at a matchup, that's the kind of matchup that you expect Omar Gonzalez to be plugged into the U.S. lineup for.
Oh, because I figured part of what makes Jeff Cameron an effective defender is that he has size as well, so he could match up with somebody like Fellini. But if Gonzalez has that same height advantage, then maybe he stays in the game.
The big difference between Gonzalez and Cameron is Gonzalez has, I believe it's 2 or 3 inches on Cameron, but Cameron's foot skills, his ability to play with the ball and you know, build from the back the way that Klinsmann likes to do is far superior to Gonzalez.
A couple of players who I had never heard of before this tournament who have really made an unbelievable impression on me and I think a lot of novice fans are Jermaine Jones and Fabian Johnson. Now, I understand that they are both dual citizens of the United States and Germany, and we're kind of fortunate to benefit from the fact that Germany is so good and so deep that they didn't need them on their national team. But is their play a surprise to you at all?
Jermaine Jones, definitely. He was always that player that whenever you saw him in a U.S. match, you were curious to see how long he was going to be able to stay on the field. His fitness, it was phenomenal, but his head was not always in the game at the right time. And he was that player that you always look to pick up a card in a game or, you know, a card in every other game.
His physicality really for American fans is, it resonates with American fans. He reminds me a lot of a, he's got a football player. American football player's mentality. He's very physical, and I like him.
Yes, I agree entirely.
There's a lot to like about Jermaine Jones.
It's that physicality that always gives you pause when you look at a game of, okay, again, how much is the ref going to let go before he pulls out that first yellow card, and then he becomes, you know, honestly a liability if it happens early enough on in the game. Because then the opposing attack is going to go right at him and try to draw that, you know, that basketball, you know, fifth foul on the center.
And Fabian Johnson, who I had never heard of until the World Cup, you're going to know better than I do. I think he already plays in the Bundesliga or perhaps the Premier League, but that guy's a star.
He's phenomenal. This has been his coming out party, no question.
He already does probably make a lot of money, but that guy's going to make a lot of money on the pitch in his career.
No question. He's the scary thing is he's actually playing out of position. His primary role for his club team has been in the midfield. And depending on what kind of lineup, the U.S. has played with at times, he's played both, in the midfield and in defense for the U.S. And with the way that Klinsmann has built this team now, it's been really built around two players. It's been built around Michael Bradley. And granted, with Altidore's injury, we already talked about that. That's been thrown kind of into flux, but it's also built around Fabian Johnson's ability to fly up the wing from a defensive position and drive the attack from there. He wins a ball back in his own defensive third, and he has the understanding, the mentality, and just the flat out skill to take it the entire length of the field and deliver a great final ball into the box and try to drive a score, a goal from that manner.
Yeah, he's really impressed me. So is that super sub that they bring in for the last 5-10 minutes, Yedlin. I never heard of him either. But as I was watching the United States game against Germany last week, as the game kind of wound down the final 20 minutes or so, I couldn't help but feel that the U.S. was just missing one player. And I'm wondering if a lot of fans were thinking the same thing, that if the United States had a sub to come in and maybe put a little bit more pressure on the German defense, that maybe we could have gotten a tie in that game. And at what point do you think a lot of American fans say, hey, you know what? This run by the United States is amazing, but could still use Landon Donovan.
I think the end of the Portugal game was really when that narrative started developing. You know, the team had such a great win against Ghana in the first game and was so solid throughout the game after those first 5 minutes that there wasn't really, for most people, any cause to question whether or not Landon Donovan should have been in that game. But then Portugal happened, and simple mistakes like, you know, Bradley's giveaway, but even leading up to that, when Yedlin was inserted, and this is his youth. You know, the kid is 20, maybe 21 years old, maybe 22. He's got a long way to go. He's inserted into a game. There's 5 minutes left. He gets a ball. He heads straight down the field. He's got speed to burn. And then he tries to deliver a ball to score another goal. You know, that's the kind of game management that he just doesn't have yet from pure lack of experience. Whereas if you had put in Donovan in that situation, he gets that ball, he goes straight for the corner flag, he just holds it and, you know, kills more clock, and forces Portugal to come to him instead of losing the ball. Portugal can do a quick counter, try to build up through the middle. And then when Bradley loses the ball in the dead center of the field, now you're in trouble.
Yeah. I think it was Taylor Twellman who said that, because you only have 23 players on a roster, you need all of those players to be viable options at some point during the game. You have to be able to look down on the bench and say, that guy can play right now. And the grueling nature of the group stage for the United States, where they had a ridiculous amount of travel, where they had to play in the middle of the Amazon. I mean, there were a lot of tired bodies on that field for the United States against Germany. And I felt that was a situation where you insert a veteran like a Landon Donovan and puts a little bit more pressure on the German defense. And so I do think there are still many fans who wonder if the roster would be better with a Landon Donovan. And but it's also been nice to see a lot of these kids who you've never heard of before perform. And so certainly Klinsmann has been validated to this point, and emerging from the group of death, getting into the knockout stage of the tournament, I would say that most fans would say, win or lose against Belgium, this has been a tremendous success for the United States.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the day that the draw was made, you know, I removed myself from the work in the school day environment just to sit in my office because I was so nervous. And then, you know, I ran into you. I ran into, you know, other people here. And I'm almost positive I had just a pale, ghostly look on my face. Like, this is not going to go well this summer. So to come out of that situation, yeah, this is, it's been a success in any other year for the U.S. in the World Cup. The big difference this year is just the added exposure as social media has taken over, as the game times are so much more convenient as opposed to, say, South Africa 4 years ago. The general soccer knowledge and exposure in the country has now has us looking at, okay, great, you got out of the essentially the first round. You got to do better than that. You got to keep pushing it.
Yeah, I feel the same way in that when the groups were announced, that most people did not give the United States much of a chance, and here they are now in the round of 16. And I think most people would say that it has been a success, this World Cup for the United States. But I feel as if the United States has a pretty good shot against Belgium, and I think it's okay to be disappointed by the results if the United States does not prevail tomorrow, Tuesday, which kind of connects to the next point that I wanted to mention, which is that you mentioned social media, and you mentioned how popular soccer is becoming in this country, due in part to social media. But there's also been some backlash, and some of that backlash surrounds the idea that in the World Cup in soccer, you don't always have to win to advance. And so people were somewhat critical of the United States cheering and United fans, the United States cheering after their loss to Germany because, you know, Portugal beats Ghana, United States advances because of points. That's how the group stage works. Soccer fans understand that, but there were a lot of people who don't appreciate soccer, who aren't soccer fans, who were somewhat critical of cheering for a loss. And I kind of, you know, I wouldn't call myself a diehard soccer fan, but I was feeling the need to defend soccer when people were critical of cheering for the loss. And you know, I was watching the Baltimore Orioles, that Buck Showalter was asked a question in a pregame interview about what he thinks of the World Cup so far. And he was like, let me get this straight. You know, we're cheering for a loss. You know, that doesn't make any sense to me. You know, in this country, we don't cheer for losses. That's just a foreign concept to me. And I felt that comment and comments like that on Twitter are kind of ignorant. And it perhaps shows us that as a country, we are somewhat divided in our appreciation for the game of soccer, which is by far the most popular sport in the world. Yet the United States kind of separates itself from the rest of the world in its appreciation for soccer. And I wonder if this is certainly not new to you, because you have been a soccer fan for a lot longer than I have, but this kind of lack of understanding and context from a lot of Americans, does it still bother you like it's starting to bother me now?
Oh, absolutely. No question. And you know, I hate to bring it up, because every broadcaster, every writer on Twitter has mentioned it and, you know, tries to avoid it because it's such a detestable thing that happened. But the piece that Ann Coulter wrote that took off like wildfire about how soccer is so un-American and it's destroying the fabric of American society.
Was that the soccer fans are terrorists piece?
Soccer fans are terrorists. you know, the fact that, you know, I hated it so much. It actually, the best critique of it that I saw out there was, one of my friends who, granted, he's very liberal in his political leaning. So of course despises the woman anyway. He said that if you read it and pictured Stephen Colbert giving those exact words on the Colbert Report, you would think that it was the funniest thing in the world.
But it's a piece of satire.
Absolutely. It was pure satire, but she wrote it completely seriously.
She doesn't have the intelligence to understand satire.
No, she does not. But yeah, it does bother me, because if you took soccer out of that equation and let's plug in the NFL, and on the last day of the season, if you could manage the clock perfectly, that every game, that the game started at the same time, ended at the same time, and you have the Patriots and the Jets playing, and the Patriots are winning the game, and the Jets need to either win or they need the Bills to lose against Miami to make the playoffs. And all of a sudden, the Bills lose to Miami. The Jets are in, but they just lost the game. No one would have a problem with that because it's the regular season. The group stage is the regular season. You're trying to move on to the playoffs. And however you get into the playoffs, it doesn't matter as long as you make the playoffs. And that's the parallel that the non-soccer fan in this country doesn't either get or doesn't want to get. And it's the fact that they might not want to get it. That's what bothers me the most.
Right. And I've been amazed at how this World Cup has really transcended a lot of things in this country. I mean, when you go to bars to watch these games and you're with people who you don't normally associate with, I'm talking different ages, politics, races, socioeconomic, you name it. Universally, this team, this United States team during this World Cup is being celebrated. And it's really kind of cool to be a part of such a diverse audience, of people watching these games. But yet I can't help but feel that with part of this response to this whole "we cheer losing" concept is a little bit of an attempt to divide soccer fans and the sport of soccer from other sects of America. I'm not calling it necessarily a red or a blue division, as far as strictly political, but it does seem as if soccer has been more embraced by liberal portions of this country. I'm wondering if that's your experience with being a soccer fan in this country before or prior to this World Cup. Does it seem to be a sport that is embraced by more liberal, socially forward groups of people in this country?
I would have to say yes. And again, my exposure was certainly limited, growing up where in central Massachusetts and growing up in a very diverse community. I grew up in a town of about 35,000 people, but it had a very heavy Brazilian and a very heavy Portuguese population. So we definitely, growing up, I definitely had that exposure from, an immigrant mentality, immigrant population who brought the game with them, who still cheered for their parents' national teams, their parents' club teams in other countries, at a time when soccer was not big here. But just the natural course of soccer history in the country has been that it's a very suburban, upper middle class sport for some reason, be it a location based situation. There are certain soccer hotbeds in the country. DC area is certainly one of them. Is that a political statement or a fact? Are politics a factor of that? I don't know. But the liberal versus conservative, red versus blue, attitude that seems to come up every time soccer comes up. I would say it's more than political leaning. It has more to do with upbringing. It's, soccer for many is viewed as an immigrant sport. And let's face it, most immigrants in America, be it first, second, recent immigration to America are going to be liberal because of the way that they came to the country and were embraced by the liberal leaning political parties as opposed to the conservative leaning political parties.
Yeah. You hate to make it a question of politics, but I do think it's part of the discussion and narrative when we look back on this World Cup is that, who has really embraced this World Cup and this run by the United States and who has resisted. And I'm sure there's a way to track this data, but I wonder how divided we are based on our politics. I'm sure there is some sort of minor correlation. Last question area for us to focus on here would be outside of the United States and Belgium tomorrow. Storylines moving forward. I don't know if you've been surprised by anything that's happened in any of the other games in the round of 16, but once again, you know, to go back to this point about Americans not understanding soccer, there was a lot of criticism in this country around the world after the result of the Netherlands-Mexico game yesterday, as far as the penalty that was called, as far as Robin's dramatization of contact. You know, a lot of people take to Twitter and say, well, that's why soccer is different, because look at all the flopping, look at all the acting. And I think for a lot of people in this country, that personified why they resist being a soccer fan. It's because look at that mentality of flopping. That doesn't exist in other sports in this country. That doesn't happen in football. That doesn't happen in basketball and baseball. And I actually called BS on that a week or so ago. I wrote a little bit about how flopping is as much a part of the sports Americans love watching as it is in soccer. And the examples that I highlighted were from the NBA Finals. When you look at the best players in basketball and the best teams, somebody like a LeBron James and a Dwayne Wade, those guys are experts at the art of flopping. And it's no different than a Robin for the Netherlands yesterday against Mexico. Unfortunately, I think the result yesterday with the Netherlands over Mexico has really tainted, for a lot of potential fans, the legitimacy of soccer.
Absolutely. And every sport has that thing, be it something tangible, like a quartz bat in baseball that you can latch onto, or the steroid controversy is, you know, probably the biggest one of, you know, of an immediate parallel, where the so-and-so did it, but you don't know if the pitcher that threw to Mark McGwire, you don't know if he was doing it. You know, it's all situational in how people look at it. And it's part of the sport. It's an unfortunate part of the sport. But the criticism that gets thrown at players when it happens, is fair and unfair at the same time. It's fair because it doesn't look good it doesn't reflect well on the sport and on the individual player, but it's not fair because if the teams were completely reversed, it's going to happen against them as well. It's become just a part of the sport where you're trying to sell something that may or may not have happened to a smaller or greater degree. You know, it's the NFL player getting held and throwing his arms up because he can't get by the offensive lineman.
Right. It happens in all sports.
Yeah.
And the last thing I'll say is that this World Cup is better with Mexico in it rather than out of it, because I have thoroughly enjoyed the antics of that side, including their coach. I must say that they made the experience a much happier experience for me, and I'm actually sad to see Mexico going home, especially the way they did. Okay, so we're feeling good about tomorrow's game. Thanks for the time, and go USA.
Go USA.
Thanks, buddy.